Spanish Roja, and I grow Italian red or Italian purple, which is an artichoke variety. There's a curing of it.
Now, are you wholesaling that? Are you?
I direct market it. Direct market it. No problem. I could grow twice as much and sell it.
Are you, do you breed it or?
We have, but it's. Yeah, it's
a lot of time.
Time's one thing, and then it just sells so fast that pretty soon I'm down to barely having enough seed to put in the ground for next year.
How do you dry it out then?
It sets on, I try and get them so they don't touch each other, and they're laying on the stalk of the one below it, so it's not on the plastic.
Okay.
And then I dry it in the shade inside the barn.
Okay.
No less than 10 days, but not usually more than 15.
Okay.
And then you clean it.
Yeah.
That's Spanish Roja with the hard top. Cut the root. You want to, when you harvest, you want to make sure you got 9, 10 protective skins around it, unless you're not going to store it. But most people want to buy a mount for winter.
Now, are you certified organic when you're growing as well?
Yeah. The whole ranch, everything we do,
okay.
Even the Christmas tree.
Here's Ivan.
Remember those pants? Three. Spinach behind Don, and sangria, Johnny's red leaf. And this looks like romaine. And then the other is Simpson.
That looks like I'm trying to leave here. Market morning.
But we'll often take like 8 of those tubs.
Do you put them in coolers when you go to the markets?
No, it doesn't last that long. It's sold in about a half hour.
Yeah.
20. It's a madhouse. If you don't have 2 or 3 people working the front line at the market, you're just so swamped you go bananas. Yeah, this is sweet. Don gladiolus.
Switch.
We do a lot of carrots. Same with the lettuce. We have 3 plantings, sometimes more. I like that picture a lot. Okay, here we are at the market. Look at the mixture of people there.
Mm-hmm. You made them all wait when you took the picture.
Yeah, I wouldn't open. Bell had rang to open the market, and I said, hold on, grab your stuff.
And where's this market?
This is in Wenatchee. Old people, young people, Mexicans. And that's how it looks. They just swarm you like that. They were selling our milk. This must be a real early market because the lettuce is small. This is the Tilth Farmers Market. Now this is an interesting market. This happens once a year, and it's in Seattle, and it's at the Good Shepherd Center, and it's only organic growers.
Oh, really?
Once a year?
Once a year, and it's really fun. It's just like a big carnival. There's people playing homemade music, and all these vendors with wheat, and they come from all corners of the state, and everybody's certified, and it's just like the ultimate market.
Hubbards.
Which one?
And the nice leeks. Get the nicest leeks in Washington State.
Washington, Oregon, the cool kind.
Poor
visitor. Sorry about that, Don.
Look at little Andrew.
Is that Andrew?
But we like to lay all our stuff out in these different colored tubs. It really makes a nice display, and that's really important, is your display.
Yeah.
Oh, here we're planting Christmas trees. It's on trickle line too.
Oh, that's pretty.
Oh, that's
cool.
Nice.
Oh yeah, we're coming back in full circle now. The cattle bit, isn't it?
There's a good shot of the upper garden. I use this conditioner mower. It's a great machine. For a small scale farm like I got, it's just ideal. It windrows it and it crimps the stem of the alfalfa so it dries at the same rate as the leaf. Spits it out in the windrow.
Is that run by a Wisconsin engine? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a two-cylinder Wisconsin.
Yeah, those are the workhorse.
They are. You start it with the flywheel. You just flip it by hand. Everything's got to be just right or it won't start.
Yeah.
That's Don raking the hay. I like that picture. I often have one of the kids ride with me on the baler when I'm baling in case something goes wrong. Like if I break a bale, they can throw it back in and get the wire out. And if I need a bale rolled out of the way on a corner, they can jump off and get it.
Hey, party. Is Nick hanging out there?
Hey, party.
I did.
Let me help.
Here we go on gopher trapping.
Oh, here's the end. Steps of gopher trapping.
I use a Maccabee trap. Surefire way to do it.
Cow dog.
Gopher dog, too.
What was it you trapped? Gophers.
That's it.
Oh, that last slide, was that the sound?
That was like switching from an airplane.
Oh, because
what?
Threw it in for just variety.
Very nice.
Tail shot.
A heavenly
shot.
Yeah. Recognize that anyway.
Well, Margaret, I'm going to introduce yourself in this program. Peter Rabbit, I know that. I'm going to give you a reading here, since this is on literature.
Well, I'm Margaret Finnings, and I'm going to do the session on literature and the land. And before I start with some of my favorites, I was just going to open this up to see what are some favorite books that you've read that you feel have a connection to the land or to nature or to ecology or to the environment.
What are your favorites? Wendell Berry's books.
Okay, Wendell Berry, yeah.
That's great.
That's kind of the essence of who he is.
I just read 1,000 Acres, which has got a really strange connection to the land, but I think there is a strong tie in that.
Yeah, I've got to read that. Jackie said that you read the book. Yeah, I haven't read that yet. I did buy one of her short stories and read one of them.
Who's the author?
Jane Smiley.
Jane Smiley. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1992. And it's actually a rewrite of King Arthur.
Dividing Land and that kind of thing.
I just read a book by Ann Dillard. It's kind of the history of Bellingham and Watkins.
Oh, okay.
And well, there are a couple of things that were surprising to me. I grew up in the area pretty close. She has an excellent description of the land around the area. And she only lived there 5 years. She's Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Second thing, they didn't think too much of those big Douglas fir trees when they got there. They were a nuisance rather than an asset. And then now where all the dairy farmers are around Nooksack, they grew hops there. And that me during my lifetime was growing in the Yakima Valley. So and that was surprising. But the land was everything to the settlers who first came in.
I think one of my favorite books is Quill Eric's The Solace of Open Spaces. And we read that together on the road trip, driving through Wyoming and Alaska. And she is a California native filmmaker who came to the Montana, Wyoming area to document sheep herders and the Basque, not the Basque, just to document that lifestyle. And she ended up staying. And the way that she describes the scenery and people, it's really, it is some of the most interesting reading that I've done. And I love that person. I've read everything at first.
The Solitude of Empty
Spaces. The Solace of Open Spaces.
Of Open Spaces.
It was in the bookstore, I know this.
She's
been struck by lightning twice.
Oh.
Last time we heard her read, she was not her old self.
Oh.
Mm. But she married a rancher in the area, lives in Northern Wyoming on a big cattle ranch. And they are now practicing they're doing grading, and they're doing some alternative grading techniques.
Yeah, original species of grass that returned to the area. She said the conventional ranchers sort of look at cross-eyed.
Yeah.
But now they're kind of curious. Yeah. They get all kinds of grass.
Yeah, and they're interesting.
I would just mention a couple movies that I very much land-based from. It's their hair, actually. Jean de Florette and The Man in the Spring. And it's about a Frenchman who inherits his family home and farm. And there's some despicable diversion of water by the neighbors. And his struggle, in fact, his innovative way of farming and actually almost succeeding, even though he has to haul water on a donkey from the well in town. And sort of how over generations the land is this means to an end. It's also, you know, the fruitfulness of an agrarian lifestyle. It's real powerful. Film, it even stands sometimes.
I brought a couple books. This is a kind of a new bestseller. This definitely is about, this is essays on the land. She calls it Dakota. She actually moves back to Lemon, South Dakota, but it's on the border of North Dakota. And so she talks about the whole territory as Dakota. And this, Jackie, you heard her read, right?
Yeah, she did a book reading in Seattle. That was the national book tour. She's from New York, but spent summers on her grandmother's farm, I believe.
Yeah.
And was drawn back for that reason. So she really, can write about it from sort of an observer standpoint. It's really good.
Yeah, I haven't read all of it. I've started. It's an essay type, so you can pick it up, read it, put it down, that kind of thing. But
kind of a modern version of, in some ways, like Sarah Fair Lewis's Main Street. There's flavors of what it's like to be in rural life.
Yeah, really interesting thing about rural life. And this is a newer book too, The Controversial, The Education of Little Tree. Controversial that it was supposed to be autobiography, and it used to be listed under autobiography, but then it wasn't.
The final word is it's not.
No, it isn't. And you know, actually when I was reading it, I felt it was a little bit contrived with the language, but it does really have some, it's a good story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good story. How many of you have read this one? Okay. I was just gonna, I thought I would start out with this one, and then actually it put the literature I really got some old classics. But it's a story of a little boy, a Cherokee boy, who was raised by his grandparents. And they try to raise him in the old way, they call it, which is definitely the way of listening to nature a little bit more, learning from nature. And this is just a scene where he and his grandpa watch the morning happen. Above the rim of the farthest mountain, on the end of the world, a pink streak whipped across a paintbrush swept a million miles across the sky. Morning wind picked up and hit our faces, and me and Grandpa knew the colors and the morning birth had come alive. The paintbrush ran up in streaks, red, yellow, and blue. The mountain rim looked like it had caught fire. Then the sun cleared the trees. It turned the fog into a pink ocean, heaving and moving and moving down below. The sun hit me and Grandpa in the face. The world had got born all over again. So sort of the analogy of each morning being a new birth of the world. And it's full of excellent images that way. And in fact, his education is through nature. So, well, the classics I brought, one is Giants in the Earth. Are you familiar with this one? Now, you probably would be more familiar with this if you went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, where you would have to read this because Rollbug is the author of it, and he was a teacher at St. Olaf. Actually, it's the story of the Norwegian immigrants and their story. But it's not only about the Norwegians. If you read it, it's the idea of a pioneering spirit. And one of the things about the book, Per Hansa, the main character, it kind of shows us our connection to nature because he really doesn't see his connection. He's always trying to conquer. And he sees nature as there for him to take. And I was just going to point out some of those passages to you. It's probably takes place in the Dakotas, Minnesota, Dakotas, that area. So it's real prairie oriented. This is when he goes. He's now on his homestead, and he's going to plant wheat. He's outside, and he's grabbing this wheat. He gave another grab, closing his hand still tighter. Again, the yellow kernels slipped through his fingers like squirming eels. Then Per Hansa threw back his head and laughed. "These fellows aren't very anxious to go into the ground after riches for me." He ran his hand around in the bag, stroking the grain caressingly, taking great handfuls, giving them a gentle squeeze. And now the wheat rained down in yellow semicircles from Per Hansa's hand. As the seed fell, the warm rays of the sun struck full across it and seemed to wrap it in golden light. Per Hansa restrained himself, looking slowly and carefully. The seeding must be even and not too thick. But almost at once, he grew very heated. His body was dripping with sweat. He couldn't explain this for a while. It wasn't hard work at all. "Oh well," he thought at last. "That's always the way when you tackle a job you don't understand." And he really doesn't understand this. It's the images of the wheat and the gold and that they're going to get riches for him. What happens in here is he's planted this actually too soon. He's so anxious to get ahead of his neighbors that he goes out and he plants this wheat. The sun touched the horizon and flattened over it. I think that's such an interesting contrast, that idea of death and life, and how that's just a natural cycle. And, you know, one moment this grandpa's dead, life began to move again. Mm-hmm. There's no time for that, you just keep going, and this is sort of a natural understanding of the cycles. And there's something about where the sun and the horizon flatten over, it's kind of peaceful about that. Right? So, and another place when, when the Joes have been through all of this, like maybe doesn't even seem humanly possible. And I think we're getting like drained from reading this, and now it's not the dust, but it might be. But it's then they have all the rain, and and it's gray, and it rains and rains for days and days, and it's gray, and they're living in a boxcar, and they're getting flooded out of their boxcar. But here's another beautiful image of the sort of the benevolence of nature, too. The rain stopped. On the fields, the water stood reflecting in the gray sky, and the land whispered with moving water. And the men came out of the barns, out of the sheds. They squatted on their hands and looked out over the flooded land, and they were silent. And sometimes they talked very quietly. No work till spring, no work. And if no work, no money, no food. Fell had a team of horses, had to use them to plow and cultivate and mow, wouldn't think of turning them out to starve when they wasn't working. Them's horses, we're men. The women watched the men, watched to see whether the break had come at last. The women stood silently and watched, and where a number of men gathered together, the fear went from their faces and anger took its place. And the women sighed with relief, for they knew it was all right. The break had not come, and the break would never come as long as fear could turn to wrath. Tiny points of grass came through the earth, and in a few days, the hills were pale green at the beginning year. And he takes that sense of their sense of hope and puts it into a natural image of the green coming through. And then in another place there's this image of a color from nature. With the two children, Ruthie and Winfield, they're the youngest, and throughout the story, you know, all this is going on, and they're just kids. And they don't quite understand it or know what's going on, and they're just being kids. And so all this rain and flooding is happening, and the little kids are playing along the street, and they find this scraggly geranium, and they kind of fight over it. Ahead beside the road, Ruthie saw a spot of red. She raced to it. A scraggly geranium gone wild, and there was one rain-beaten blossom on it. She picked the flower. She took a petal carefully off and stuck it on her nose. Winfield ran up to see. "Let me have one," he said. "No, sir, it's all mine. I found it." She stuck another red petal on her forehead, a little bright red heart. Just love that image of that flower. So I think, in all of it, it's just full of images, but definitely a real story about people of the land being forced from the land. And then that kind of understand that connection to the land, where we're connected, what happens when we don't feel that connection, and the profit of marketing is important. Okay, and then my last one is my absolute favorite short story of all time. And it's by Willa Cather, and the name of the story is Neighbor Osiki. Now, I don't know, has anyone read that? Probably wouldn't be as likely to read that unless you were like American literature teacher or something, or taking classes on it, or a real Willa Cather fan. If you know much about Willa Cather, she usually writes about the Bohemians, Czechoslovakians in Nebraska, and their settlement. Anton Rosicky is a man that's from Bohemia, or from Czechoslovakia, and he ends up in Nebraska because he realizes that's kind of the good life. So to me, it's sort of the story of what is the good life, and maybe the story is kind of like that's it. This is I just want the story goes, it's written in a very interesting way where you meet this man, and then you kind of go back and find out about his life. There was a time when he lived in London, and he was a tailor, and there was a time when he was in New York because he'd come to America for the good life, and it kind of goes back and forth with different parts of his life. Hopefully I picked out passages enough to give you a sense of this. It starts out with, he's a little bit older, and Dr. Ed, the country doctor, has come to make a visit. And then Dr. Ed is reflecting on this. Sometimes the doctor heard the gossipers in the drugstore wondering why Rosicky didn't get on faster. He was industrious, and so were his boys. But they were rather free and easy, weren't pushers, and they didn't always show good judgment. They were comfortable. They were out of debt, but they didn't get much ahead. Maybe Dr. Ed reflected. People as generous and warm-hearted and affectionate as the Rossitis never got ahead much. Maybe you couldn't enjoy your life and put it into the bank, too. I like it. Maybe you couldn't enjoy your life and put it in the bank, too. In one of the parts where we go back and we kind of reconstruct his life, he talks about when he went to New York, it was a good life for like 5 years. He liked it. He liked the theater. He liked the culture. He liked being in America. He says, but as the years passed, he began to get a little restless. When spring came around, he would begin to feel fretted, and he got to drinking. He was likely to drink too much of a Saturday night. On Sunday, he was languid and heavy, getting over the spree. On Monday, he plunged into work again. So he never had time to figure out what ailed him, though he knew something did. When the grass turned green in Park Place, and the lilac hedge at the back of Trinity Churchyard put out its blossoms, he was tormented by a longing to run away. That was why he drank too much, to get a temporary illusion of freedom and wide horizons. Rossicki, the old Rossicki, could remember as if it were yesterday, the day when the young Rossicki found out what was the matter with him. It was on the 4th of July afternoon when he was sitting in Park Place in the sun. The lower part of New York was empty. Wall Street, Liberty Street, Broadway, all empty. So much stone and asphalt with nothing going on. So many empty windows. The emptiness was intense, like the stillness in a great factory when the machinery stops and the belts and bands cease running. It was too great a change. It took all the strength out of one. Those blank buildings without the stream of life pouring through them were like empty jails. It struck young Rossicki that this was the trouble with big cities. They built you in from the earth itself, cemented you away from any contact with the ground. You lived in an unnatural world, like the fish in an aquarium, who were probably much more comfortable than they ever were in the sea. It's like, but that's not what he needed, that comfort. There was something wrong with him. Somewhat characteristic of the time, find out about places to work on farms. They were always asking the farm workers in Nebraska. You know, the Bohemian community in the city would know about this, and that's how he knew about it. He goes out to the country. And that's one of the 4th of July stories, and I love it because of that idea of freedom. He really, you know, starts finding his freedom on that 4th of July day. I think that's not an accident, you know. Cather chooses that. There's another story about 4th of July. This is later on in his life, and this is after he's been on the farm. Now he's an older man, and his wife tells about a past 4th of July when they were younger on the farm. Corn, he says, there ain't no corn. They're having a picnic. That's what's going on. They're having a picnic here. And his wife asks him about, maybe I should back up a little bit. So we carried our supper down on a bottle of my wild grape wine, and everything tasted good, I can tell you. This is a picnic they had. The wind got cooler as the sun was going down, and it turned out pleasant. Only I noticed how the leaves was curled up on the linden trees. That made me think, and I asked your father if that hot wind all day hadn't been terrible hard on the gardens and the corn. Corn, he says? There ain't no corn. What are you talking about, I said. Ain't we got 40 acres? We ain't got an ear, he says, nor nobody else ain't got none. All the corn in this country was cooked by 3 o'clock today, like you'd roasted it in an oven. You mean you won't get no crop at all? I asked him. I couldn't believe it after he'd worked so hard. No crop this year, he says. That's why we're having a picnic. We might as well enjoy what we got. And that's how your father behaved when all the neighbors was so discouraged they couldn't look you in the face. And we enjoyed ourselves that year, poor as we was, and our neighbors wasn't a bit better off for being miserable. another thing I like about this is that it's a little on the sentimental side, that's maybe why I love it so much, but there's a definite element of reality about this. They would have to work hard on the farm, and probably they would never do much more than make a living. But if he could think of them as staying here on the land, he wouldn't have to fear any great unkindness for them. Hardship, certainly. It was a hardship to have the wheat freeze in the ground when seed was so high, and to have to sell your stock because you had no feed. But there would be other years when everything came along right and you caught up. Really, I sense that there's a balance. You know, there's a balanced nature. Well, in the story, neighbor Osiki dies. You know, you kind of get a foreshadowing of that at the beginning because he's having some heart problems. And it ends with that Dr. Ed has been out of town and he comes back and he thinks he needs to go out and visit the family. Dr. Ed was away when Osiki died, and for the first few weeks after he got home, he was hard driven. Every day he said to himself that he must get out to see that family that had lost their father. One soft, warm moonlight night in early summer, he started for the farm. His mind was on other things, and not until his road ran by the graveyard did he realize that Rosiki wasn't over there on the hill where the red lamplight shone, but here in the moonlight. He stopped his car, shut off the engine, and sat there for a while. A sudden hush had fallen on his soul. Everything here seemed strangely moving and significant, though signifying what, he did not know. Close by the wire fence stood Rosiki's mowing machine, where one of the boys had been cutting hay that afternoon. His own workhorses had been going up and down there. The new cut hay perfumed all the night air. The moonlight silvered the long, billowy grass that grew over the graves and hid the fence. The few little evergreens stood out black in it, like shadows in a pool. The sky was very blue and soft. The stars were rather faint because the moon was full. For the first time, it struck Dr. Ed that this was really a beautiful graveyard. He thought of city cemeteries, acres of shrubbery and heavy stone, so arranged and lonely and unlike anything in the living world. Cities of the dead, indeed, cities of the forgotten, of the put away. But this was open and free, this little square of long grass which the wind forever stirred. Nothing but the sky overhead and the many-colored fields running on until they met that sky. The horses worked here in summer. The neighbors passed on their way to town, and over yonder in the cornfield, Rosiki's own cattle would be eating fodder as winter came on. Nothing could be more undeath-like than this place. Nothing could be more right for a man who had helped to do the work of great cities and had always longed for the open country and had got to it at last. Rosiki's life seemed to him complete and beautiful. So, these are some of my favorites. Any comments?
I like hearing the past, the old experience, the way it was.
Uh-huh.
I think we're losing that too fast.
Well, and I think, like, you know, what is most valuable? Also, in this book, they talk about a thing called valuing, and that there's a spirit mind and a physical mind, and the physical part gets you, you know, you have to have food and you have to have drink, all of it. But what about the spiritual part of it? And I think that, you know, when you talk about the good life, you have to really call in the question, well, what does that mean spiritually? What is that part of? I say maybe another story that you might be familiar with that's, I think, definitely part of this idea of, you know, kind of understanding of nature is to build a fire. Have you all read that one? Jack London?
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
When the guy, freezes to death?
Yeah. Right.
That's the story I remember.
Yeah. That's, and that one, actually, I have some quotes from that in here where it says, Jack London writes that the trouble with him was that he was without
magic. He's joking.
Okay.
Yeah, that was close, Mom. Shoot 32 times.
Yeah.
It's a skin.
watching you.
It does. He says, the trouble with him was that he was without imagination. He was quick and alert in the things of life, but only in the things, and not in the significances. And this story, that's a fun one if you remember it, because the dog survives, but he doesn't. You know, and it's like the dog was connected instinctually to nature. Is able to survive, but he just takes care of the immediate things. And not a lot of in a lot of this literature, I think what you get is if people don't understand nature, they don't understand the consequences for misusing it. Mm-hmm. Like Per Hansen's consequence, I mean, is the ultimate one. Mm-hmm. Dies in the storm. The Grapes of Wrath, there's sort of this struggle back and forth. You know, there's a consequence of poor agriculture, we've got the dust storm. But a lot of it is other consequences brought on by other people. There's a lot of that in literature. You know, the thing that I like about the fact that this is like old classic stuff, I think one of the points is that it's always been there. It is a part of who we are. It's not something new, although it's great we're having new books written that are all about land and place, but it's not just a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, part of our spirit.
Well, it's something I've thought all my life, is you can take the person out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the person.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, my wife worked, it was in the suburbs, uh-huh. And married a suburbanite, and you always yearn to go back the way it was.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you have to make a commitment if you do.
Yeah.
And that's hard to make for most people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, and there are, you know, I think the way society moves us along sometimes is such a battle to fight against that. You know? Like Dan talking about the movement of people from rural areas to the city. I mean, I didn't. I mean, kind of more recently, I did teach in rural Minnesota, but and we hope to not stay there forever. But it's like I knew when I was growing up that I wasn't going to stay in Minnesota because that mean I hadn't done anything with my life. You know?
Well, the suburbanites destroy the land too, like the Kent Valley. Is gone in my life.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just disappeared.
Yeah. And you can't get it back.
No.
No, it's gone.
I was thinking of a lot about Thoreau and the plot of essays in Sans Winter.
Oh, great.
And how he was belittled or maybe even scorned for his habits of just being in nature and just observing. His time was considered idle. To sit in the woods and to observe while there were lumberjacks working in the woods, and that's what he should be doing.
Yeah. Well, that goes against that whole, like the Per Hansen, get out there, you've got a westward expansion. And I think a lot of the reasons why we are so disenfranchised from Indian culture and think, you know, why we label it lazy and blah, 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 it's like, you know, like, what is the idle hands of the devil's whatever it is, you know, all of that stuff. That's part of that. But we, and not saying that some of that stuff isn't valuable, but it's just a real disproportionate valuing system.
Mm-hmm. I think also this next generation is losing a sense of the land in that they don't want a big lot to garden or have a lawn on. They want it small. They want to go to the Pack West Club, they want to run and do everything else except get their hands in the soil.
Yeah.
They don't know how to read.
Uh-huh. That's all part of it too. Yeah.
You know, so no matter if there are good books, old, new, or whatever.
No time. You know, there's no time
there's
to read.
There's no time. There's no interest.
Yeah.
No, it's not a video presentation. And, you know, I'm really concerned that the future is going to be pretty bleak because there's, functional illiterates is what we've got.
Yeah.
Well, like, and even beyond that, there are people who are literate but have no attention span.
Yeah.
to engage in.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think, as someone who's teaching currently, although, I mean, do you think people are being beckoned back to this in terms of literature? What do people choose to read? One read?
I'm not real sure. I guess as a teacher right now, I can't answer that because I just teach language, you know, without literature. And I'm teaching to international students, and what they're interested in is most of business. I would say the majority are, you know, how they can, because if they can learn English, then that's going to help them in their lives in their own countries. I would say, like, and I work with kind of a young co-workers that are actually pretty well read. I mean, I don't even know. A lot of them are French majors reading all this French stuff. So, I don't know about that.
I do think, though, that we have a portion of our population is very literate.
Uh-huh.
But I'd say what a lot of it just the people read now is exactly what they see on television. Sex and violence and Grisham, the Pelican Brief and literature like that.
I know when I was teaching high school, I was impressed. I could say, all you want to read Stephen King. But I think it's fast, it's exciting, it, you know, grips them, and that's the kind of stuff. But
idea that we have to really get back to basics and start reading to the children.
Yeah.
I think is probably in the long haul going to pull us out, if anything.
Yeah.
And they have to learn to love to read.
Uh-huh.
And they have to realize what the benefits are. And that's not obvious to them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Beyond the reading, though, I think just storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's my father didn't read me books, he told me stories.
Uh-huh.
And I remember those stories.
Yeah.
So I'm not disputing the importance of being able to read, but we're not a storytelling people anymore.
Yeah.
We're gossiping people, but we're not a storytelling people.
Yeah. Well, I'd say definitely the television, I would say, has played a big part in that. And, maybe like Steinbeck wrote against the mechanization of the tractors, I think that would go right into the television and technology and that, where there's not relationship, like you're saying, father told his stories, there's a relationship, or a parent or an adult reading to a child, it's a relationship, and then you start feeling that love, I think that's kind of the same.
I think that I got left out on the practical side, My dad immigrated, he should have been a preacher or a teacher, and was a common laborer, and tried to be a farmer.
Uh-huh.
And I was never shown anything mechanically, nor building-wise. And still not a except common labor with my hands.
It does seem amazing that we've kind of lost most of those skills that, I remember my parents making soap, doing cracklings, stuffing their own sausage, butchering cattle, head cheese, the whole bit, the nine yards, and none of my brothers or sisters do that.
Uh-huh.
So in some ways it's like, I kind of feel like it's been lost. It really was, and for most people it was lost a generation before me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But somehow I'm kind of one step out, or such. I'm like, maybe I'm one step in.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So knowing how to do more of those things, but it's pretty interesting to kind of people's understanding of where things come from.
Yeah.
They just totally lost.
Mm-hmm.
Any concept. I think that's reflected in what is being written today. I do think that there seems to be more violence and more some sex because it sells.
Yeah.
But I, on the other side of it is I also think that some of the stuff that is written is highly inflammatory. I can just think of, I like Diet for a New American by John Robbins, but you know, he attributes everything to the fact that we're eating meat. I mean, everything.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, and as you read on, it's a real, I identified with that book and I thought it was an excellent book. But as I read on, it was like, absolutely everything was associated with eating meat. And it's like, so.
Come on.
Yeah. We can be a little bit bigger than this. It can't be everything.
Well, and then you see, like, Grant talking about his farm, where the cows are integral part of that. So
right.
It's like, you can't just say, can I read this terrible? I mean, that serves a purpose.
Right. My father, who is a gardener, my sisters have all moved to a small town called St. Cloud, Minnesota, about 40,000 people, and they live in the burbs, but they all have a gardening ethic from my parents of value. And so my father loaded up, he has a 2-ton dump truck, and he loaded up 5-10 yards of cow manure and hauled it into the city. And it's well composted cow manure. And my sisters have plots and wonderful gardens. I mean, incredible, bountiful gardens. And like the neighbors come over and say, well, next year when your father comes over, will he bring me some of that stuff? So I think that there is hope in the fact that at least once people understand that, you know, it doesn't just help to go out and buy 5 bags of steer manure at, you know, Rainbow Foods and dump it on and then expect, but it takes a little bit bigger process.
Yeah.
So it's kind of exciting to, you know, because their gardens are just incredibly bountiful.
Well, that's a switch. When the country starts bringing its shit to the city.
That's right.
That's right.
It's
what time is it?
It's after 5.
Okay. Well, thanks. Dinner's at 5:30, and I wanted to just check in. We're going to have kind of this forum tonight, and I'm hoping to invite, I'll make another announcement, try and get more, you know, some people from the community here. In particular, possibly some of the cooks or kitchen people to talk maybe some about food here at Holden and stuff. But I want everybody to kind of think about taking some of the discussions that we've had to this point. And although we've been talking, I mean, certainly your presentation, Grant, involved a lot of your faith in your work. And so I want to begin to maybe talk more explicitly about that after dinner in that next session. So. I also wanted to mention that I have a few slides from our farm, and I didn't even know when to
incorporate
them here. Yeah, it's nothing near as long as this, and I was going to either say, if people aren't tired right now, we could just run through them for about 20 minutes, or we could do it right after dinner, but I think it might be easier right now.
Yeah.
So let me just run and get it. And we can...
you encourage... What am I searching for? People to come out and see what you're doing.
Are you distributing?
I really do need it. I try and take on apprentice every year if I can find one. And tentatively done talks like this at other conferences.
I'm thinking of your boys. They have school classes.
Yeah.
They come out on a field trip to...
But I talked to the ag teacher at high school about doing maybe a 1-week or a 2-week section in the spring on alternative sustainable agriculture. And he was up for it. So I just have to pursue my connection and go through with my dream.
Do you like people to come out and see what you're doing?
All the time.